Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Protests of racial injustice and the debate on how police can best do their jobs continued this week. Amid the calls for defunding the police are calls for police departments to be more transparent about officers' disciplinary records. And for the second time in history, the New Hampshire House meets somewhere other than the State House. These and other stories were covered in the news this week, and we're going to talk about them in this hour. If you have questions or comments about this busy week of news, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. It's 1-800-892-NHPR. And joining us for this part of the program, Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor, joining us by Skype, and Paul Kuno Booth, assistant local news editor and senior reporter for the Keene Sentinel. Thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, good to be here.
So let's start by talking a bit about transparency when it comes to policing. Ethan, you reported this week about how hard it is for the public to learn about police officers who have been disciplined and why. You wrote that we know more about Derek Chauvin's record than we know about any single officer in New Hampshire. Chauvin was charged with third-degree murder for the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and laws in Minnesota are different than they are here. So, Ethan, what can we know about Chauvin that we can't know about officers here in New Hampshire?
Well, crucially, we can know about his history of misconduct complaints. So Derek Chauvin has had 17 previous misconduct complaints before he was filmed with his knee on George Floyd's neck. And we know this because the city of Minneapolis includes a database that actually allows you to look up misconduct complaints against specific officers. And this is something that is lacking in New Hampshire and has been something that transparency advocates have been pushing for years, but that has experienced a lot of kind of entrenched opposition from both Republican and Democratic governors, their attorneys general, and lawmakers of both parties. And so New Hampshire does have an equivalent of sorts. It's not quite the exact analog, but there is a list called the Lori List, and it's a list that is compiled by the Attorney General's office. The idea is that in criminal cases, if you have an officer testifying, the defense needs to know if the officer, if there's anything in the officer's past that might impugn that officer's credibility. And, you know, a lot of examples might be previous misconduct complaints. So, for instance, falsifying records or using excessive force. If an officer were to testify in a case, the defense counsel needs to know that this officer has had these complaints. So the New Hampshire Attorney General's office keeps this list. There are about 275 officers on New Hampshire's list that have what are called sustained findings of misconduct. So these aren't just allegations. These are findings that have been explored by their police department and found to be sustained. And those are all kept on this list, called the Lori List. And again, they're used in court situations when there might be, the prosecutors might need to, during discovery, give these details to defense counsel. But they're not released to the public.
That was
so
my next question.
Yeah, why aren't they? Yeah.
So they're not, and no party, Democrats, Republicans, nobody has ever authorized sort of the list of these officers, Lori List, to be open to the public?
Well, so there are a few efforts that have been happening. There's a legislative effort and there's an effort in the courts. And the legislative effort has actually been bipartisan in the House. The House last year, and in previous years it's tried this as well, but last year it got the farthest it ever has. It passed a bill that would make this list public. Now, the list isn't totally private. The version that is released to the public includes a list of the police departments where these incidents have occurred, and some of the general descriptions of the misconduct. And looking at a page right now, some of them include sexual harassment, falsifying reports, excessive force, untruthfulness, false reports. So we can see that, for instance, the Nashua Police Department had a record of sexual harassment and falsifying reports. What we can't see and what's blocked out to the public is the name of the officer. So we actually have a half glimpse into it, which honestly makes it, even as a reporter, even more frustrating to try to figure out what the backstory is and kind of whether the public should be concerned. And so the legislature has been trying, some members of the legislature have been trying to release the full report so that we would see names along with the misconduct. That made it through the House last year. It passed on a voice vote. So strong bipartisan support, really not much opposition on the House floor. Then it arrived at the Senate. The Senate is often kind of, a bit slower deliberatively. And sometimes, especially when it comes to police efforts, police reform efforts, I'm thinking of the death penalty repeal, for instance, the Senate has often been the check on the House when it comes to that. And the Senate unanimously in January voted to shelve that. And so that bill did not move forward. There's also an effort in the courts. There are a number of newspapers, including, full disclosure, the Concord Monitor, that are teaming up with the American Civil Liberties Union to sue the Department of Justice in New Hampshire to try to release that report. And that case has now made it to the state Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So there are efforts, but there has been opposition at both the gubernatorial level. Governor Chris Sununu, I asked him about this a week ago, and he said he does not want to release the list at this time. And
why not? What's his argument?
The argument that you hear from people who don't want to release this list is it's about due process, they say. They say that this list includes officers who may have been added to it a decade ago, two decades ago. And, if you release them all, they may not even be police officers anymore. This might kind of sweep up certain officers that shouldn't be on the list. But proponents of transparency push back at that because in 2018, Attorney General Gordon McDonald actually changed the way that the list is set up. And they say that it kind of absolves those concerns about due process. Now, in order to get on the list, the finding needs to be sustained. When the lists were first created in 2004, the findings did not need to be sustained. So anybody could theoretically end up on there, whether or not the complaint was founded or not. Now there needs to be a relative degree of certainty from the police department to put the name on the list. And so advocates for transparency say that kind of erodes the argument that these officers shouldn't be on the list and that the public shouldn't see their names. So the list has been, since 2018, revised. And this was done with the support of police unions. They were happy to get this process. They were happy to have no longer kind of a black mark over certain officers who didn't believe that they should be. This is something that now, chiefs essentially sign off on their officers showing up on this list. And so the argument now that advocates are making is that due process argument that's being presented by the governor no longer holds, and that the list should be subject to the right to know law and released as other records are.
Mm-hmm. And Ethan, we started this conversation talking about, being able to see Derek Chauvin's record of complaints. Do you happen to know if those complaints in Minnesota had been substantiated, or were they just complaints that were either substantiated or not?
I actually don't know that. I'm not exactly sure the process for the complaints being vetted. But again, I think that it's a matter. Minneapolis has decided, I think, that kind of all complaints should be made public. And some of the complaints, one of the complaints in Chauvin's case was that he pulled a woman over who'd been speeding over 10 miles over the speed limit and needlessly detained her, put her into her car, searched her vehicle. And so that kind of behavior does point to, potential patterns that kind of, in this case, played out in tragedy.
Well, listeners, we'd love to hear from you on this. Should New Hampshire follow other states and provide information about police misconduct, substantiated or not? Do you think it would make a difference in the way police do their jobs? Let us know. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. And I want to turn to you, Paul Kuno Booth of the Keene Sentinel, because you've done some reporting on the city of Keene to prevent the release of some documents related to police use of force. And there was a right-to-know request filed 3 years ago by a Keene State College professor. Can you tell us a little bit about this effort? What was the original request? Why was it made in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is actually a pretty complicated case involving, you know, five different requests from five different journalism students. But the one that's sort of relevant to this conversation involves citizen complaints of police misconduct with the Keene Police Department. Again, these would presumably be allegations that may or may not have been verified. But one of these students requested complaints from certain years. The city denied those, I believe, for reasons related to them being internal personnel records. They did release a statistical report that I believe shows how many complaints different officers have gotten, but the names of the officers were redacted. So this lawsuit has been pending since late 2017. Just this month, there was a ruling from the Supreme Court that did, dealt with a bunch of these different issues. But one of the things it did was it sent back to the lower court this question of whether Keene needs to turn over these citizen complaints, first of all, and then also unredact the officer's name from this statistical report so you could see, which is this officer that's had, five complaints or 10 complaints or whatever. This could also be a sort of interesting early test of a recent change in the Supreme Court precedent related to personnel records. For a long time, it's been the case that anything that was considered records related to an internal personnel process that includes disciplinary proceedings was categorically exempt from disclosure. The Supreme Court recently said, actually, that was wrong. Now, if there's a disciplinary record you want to get, you have to weigh the public's right to know against the person's privacy interests and other governmental interests in non-disclosure. So that's sort of could factor into this case in an interesting way. When you're talking about.
Oh, sorry. I was just had a question. Okay. Regarding the discussion about whether or not you're weighing the public interest. Is this specific to the police, or is this to any personnel record of any government employee?
This is to any personnel record, I know there are some other statutes dealing specifically with police records that I'm sure will come into play in this case. But it does sort of, it could kind of eventually answer this question of, are complaints against police considered public records or not?
Mm-hmm. So what's next with respect to the court case?
Well, it's going back to the Superior Court, and I guess we'll see. I don't expect any answers anytime soon.
Ethan.
Yeah, I would just add that those same precedents that Paul just cited, they're also being seen as a sign of hope for the ACLU and for advocates of transparency around the Lori list. That's again the 275 officer list that New Hampshire keeps secret. That, as I mentioned, is in the Supreme Court right now, and lawyers for the plaintiffs are saying that that precedent that was set last month about transparency and about whether personnel records, the extent to which they can be shielded from the right to know law, that'll actually help out a lot. And it could potentially mean that the Supreme Court rules to release the Lori list sometime this year. But we'll have to see.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Kristen in Hopkinton. Kristen, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me and answering. As a mom who has a husband who works about 14-hour days, I'm driving with my son a lot, and I'm extrovert. I go out. I just feel like when I see cops, and I don't get to know like them in a personal way. It's one most important job. I want to feel safe, and I want to feel like whatever they've done, if there's been anything with misconduct, I want to know. And I just feel like that holding people accountable, especially in small towns, they're going to change their ways. Unfortunately, we're driven in this culture and in small towns about our egos. I just feel feel like we're held accountable, we're going to be able to maybe make some change there. And yeah, again, I just want to be able to feel safe that they're doing the right thing. If I go five over, they're going to be, it's going to be a safe call, especially in the back road or something like that. I don't want to feel scared.
Feeling safe with respect to police interaction. Thanks, Kristen. Really appreciate your comments. I'm sure that's part of the discussion, Paul. Making the stuff public may help people feel safer.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's part of the idea. I mean, with these transparency cases, you are always kind of competing these or balancing these competing interests. You do have, you know, some maybe some privacy interests, but the argument and full disclosure, Keene Sentinel is also a party to that lawyerless lawsuit. But part of this really does get to the kind of trust but verify idea. Our local departments say, you know, we have internal disciplinary processes. You know, we review every use of force to make sure it's compliant with our policy. But of course, we the public, we the reporters, don't get to actually look in at that process to know, is the process working? Are officers being disciplined when they do something wrong? Are they being, you know, fired from one place and rehired somewhere else?
Mm-hmm. And Paul, you've been doing some reporting specifically on police departments and their use of force. What can you tell us about these policies and why they're important?
Sure. So I have been trying to obtain every use of force policy for the law enforcement agencies that work in the Monadnock region. So far, I've gotten about 13 of them. Some of those are redacted. Six departments have refused to release their policies at all.
You said six departments? Sorry to interrupt. Six departments?
Yes, six departments. And
what was their reasoning for not releasing that policy? Was there one reason, or did they have many reasons?
Basically two reasons. They're relying on two particular exemptions to the state's right to know law. One is for you know, law enforcement techniques and procedures. They say that covers these documents. Some are also citing one that has to do with information that if released could endanger the life or safety of anyone. They say releasing information about how we use force could harm our officers or allow people to, I guess, evade the use of force, and that creates a more dangerous situation. No one's been able to give me a really specific answer about how exactly that would work, how people would use these policies to do that, but that's something I'm continuing to ask.
Yeah, because is this part of a right to know request or just like a casual, can you let me know what the policy is?
No, I'm filing right to know requests with these departments.
And so do you plan on fighting those refusals to disclose?
I haven't decided yet. Right now, I'm just trying to follow up with all the departments that haven't responded yet, get as complete a set as I can, and then kind of go from there. You know, getting back to the Minneapolis incident, my first question was just, you know, what do these policies say about neck restraints? Police chiefs in this area have told me, you know, we don't use those. We don't train officers to do any kind of chokehold or other sort of hold around the neck. And some of these policies do expressly limit neck restraints to situations where basically as a last resort to protect your own life or someone else's life. But a lot of these policies just don't mention them at all.
Don't mention them at all. Okay. And when we talk about neck restraints, these are different from chokeholds, right?
Yeah. So there's a chokehold would be, as I understand it, sort of pressing on the front of the neck in a way that stops someone from breathing. There's also, you know, some departments in the U.S. Differentiate that from, I think it's called a carotid hold, where it's pressure on the sides of the neck that's supposed to slow circulation and make someone go unconscious. But obviously, if you do that wrong, it can really have bad consequences. So police departments in New Hampshire, the ones I've talked to, said, you know, either kind of hold would be considered deadly force. Now, the interesting thing is I did talk to two police departments who came back to me after my request for their policy and said, you know what? In reviewing this, we noticed the policy still authorizes chokeholds, even though, you know, our officers do not use them. That was an oversight. We're going back. We're updating that. But I think that kind of speaks to the reason for looking at some of these policies.
And the impact local journalism can make, certainly. Let me ask both of you, since you've been covering a bit of the protests against racial injustice in New Hampshire, maybe start with you, Ethan. This past weekend in Concord, there were about 2,000 people who attended an anti-racism protest in Concord. How did that go?
Yeah, so that was pretty remarkable. I've only lived in the city for 3 years, but for people who lived there for decades, this was the largest gathering that they had seen at the State House. And it was a peaceful march. It went kind of about a mile down the road from the Memorial Field to the State House grounds. And then there was a number of speeches. And I think what was remarkable is just sort of the intersection of generations. A lot of it was driven by the Concord High School, as I think we've seen in a lot of these demonstrations. There was a Manchester vigil, last week that was also kind of driven by kind of young activists with Black Lives Matter Manchester. And so you had a lot of support from the younger generations, and visually you had kind of them up to the steps. They were sitting up to the steps, and then kind of in the background, you had some older generations and some support there. So yeah, it was a largely successful, it was a successful event, and it kind of, you know, as all these have been, a kind of refocused attention, I think, in at least this area, on some of the communities that are often overlooked in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Paul? What protests or marches have you seen?
Yeah, so in the Monadnock region, we haven't had anything that large, but we have had a couple of demonstrations that have been, you know, several hundred people in Keene and Peterborough, which for this part of the state is quite something. One thing that's really struck me is you're also seeing demonstrations in some of the smaller, more rural outlying communities. There have been ones in, you know, Winchester, Ringe, Walpole, Dublin, not communities I think of as sort of, population hubs or even, you know, places where you'd have a lot of activism, but that is happening there. You know, people I've talked to at these protests say, you know, they're protesting racism, police brutality. They also want to send a message that, you know, the people of color who do live in these communities are welcome there.
So how does it seem to you these rural protests are they surprising to you in any way?
Yeah, but you know, that's maybe a little bit my own bias. Obviously, you know, some of these places I do think of as more politically conservative and somewhat older, but obviously everywhere has a range of people, of views, of ages. So. You know, I do think it's when I think about it, it doesn't seem that remarkable. Ringe, for example, very small protest that I went to last weekend, but it was maybe a half a dozen people, but they said they were there 3 days straight for 7 hours each. It's organized by a couple of people who work at the Franklin Pierce University there. And again, just wanted to send this message of, you know, we welcome diverse people here in Ringe.
Mm-hmm. We get this note from Fred in Concord, who says, "I'm a former police officer in Portland, Maine, and current city council member. The discussion should not be about defunding police, but instead about oversight, accountability, and cultural change from the top down. I would also add that we have continually added to our police and huge amount of social issues that are not related to law enforcement, but due to neglect of those problems, result in law enforcement attention." So that's the note from Fred in Concord. Because defunding the police has been one of the major issues that protesters have been talking about, I wanted to ask you, what, if anything, have they been saying publicly at rallies and marches that you've seen? Maybe start with you, Ethan.
Sure. So one thing that I've been kind of struck by, I mean, I cover the legislature primarily. So when I go to these rallies and these vigils, I'm kind of listening for action items that might be taken up by the legislature. And one thing that I have noticed is that there isn't a lot that's happening on the legislative side, unlike you've seen in other states and other cities, to kind of meet this moment and meet kind of some of these ideas. And that's partly a product of where the legislative session is. But so often you'll see kind of, these ideas voiced of defund the police or police reform and how this needs to change. And then you don't really see it at the statewide level. But my colleague Alyssa Dandria has been reporting in Concord and in other cities, it's kind of happening more at the city level, these conversations, and whether it's, you know, kind of a push to literally reduce funding to the police or to kind of overhaul some of the processes, that's something that's kind of happening more locally in New Hampshire right now than it is on a statewide level. The governor has said that he, you know, he has a diversity council that that he has, you know, convened 2 years ago, and he said that that is working on solutions on statewide, but he hasn't really talked about what specifically might change in terms of state law. So I think there's just a little bit of a disconnect between some of what the especially younger protesters are saying and some of what's actually happening in New Hampshire and the pace of progress.
There might be some overlap between what Fred from Concord is writing and what some of the Black Lives Matter protesters want, which is, you know, more attention to the problems that law enforcement have to give attention to that perhaps might be left to social workers. So there might be some overlap there, some common ground for those two groups to pursue. Paul, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you if there's anything that you will be keeping an eye on with respect to either, you know, police policies or a protest coming up in the Monadnock region that you'll be covering, anything like that?
Yeah, so on that same point in Keene, we recently had a city councilor come out and say he wants to talk about ways to reimagine public safety. He's been very clear he does not want to defund the police department, but is thinking of some way to have kind of an umbrella Department of Public Safety that has, you know, police, fire, but also, you know, maybe mental health first responders of some kind. So again, to that point of do we really need the police responding to every overdose, every, you know, call that's clearly someone in mental health crisis? Are there, you know, different ways of doing something? So that's really what I'm going to be looking for on the local level. Do these discussions continue around whether it's kind of incremental reforms or, you know, is there a way to just do public safety better?
Paul Kuno Booth, assistant local news editor and senior reporter for the Keene Sentinel, thank you very much for joining us for this part of the program. Really appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor is going to stay with us for the next part of the program. We're going to take a look back at the week's news today on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And coming up after the break, the Executive Council rejected the nomination of a Black man to the State Board of Education, citing his lack of experience in education settings. The vote was along party lines, with Democrats opposed. We'll take a look at how race and politics factored into this decision. What do you make of it? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR or email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. Right now, we're talking about the week's news. And joining us for this part of the conversation, we've still got Concord Monitor reporter Ethan DeWitt joining us by Skype. And we've got Gary Reno and Paula Tracy of InDepthNH.org with us right now as well. Thank you very much, Gary, Paula. We really appreciate you being here.
Great to be here.
So, Paula, I want to start with you to talk a little bit about some Executive Council news this week. The Council voted to reject the nomination of Ryan Terrell of Nashua to the State Board of Education. Forgive me if I mispronounce his name. The vote went along party lines, with Democrats opposed. Who is this person? Who is Ryan Terrell?
Well, Ryan Terrell grew up in Louisiana and was a student at a school that was totally destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. And he went on to middle school at a charter school, wound up at Southern New Hampshire University, where he did their, it's some kind of a program which is about experiential learning. And he's an entrepreneur. He's lived in four communities in New Hampshire. And we don't know all that much about his experience. That was the question that Andrew Valinsky brought up. He said that it didn't appear that he had taken traditional routes like normal people for the Board of Education, being on PTOs, being on local school boards, or shown an interest in that. And the governor took exception to the fact that he had been moving around to various communities in the state and said that gave him experience, that he has great life experience, he's an out-of-the-box thinker, and that he would be a great asset to the 7-member Board of Education, who is losing a seasoned veteran since 2007 when Helen Hanerow, a Nashua attorney, was nominated to serve on the board by Governor Lynch. She has met her term limits, and she cannot serve any longer. So the governor was hoping that this man, who is of African-American heritage, would be a good fit. But Deborah Pignatelli, in whose district the position is, said she had 3 or 4 African-American folks that would be good to serve on the board, and that she would prefer to see Mr. Terrell on a business-related board.
Mm-hmm.
What ended up happening is the vote went down political lines 3-2 with Pignatelli, Mike Ryans of Hanover, and Valinsky all opposing. Gatsis from Manchester said that he would like to see what he could do. Councillor Russ Prescott from Kingston agreed. The vote did not go the governor's way. And at a press conference yesterday, the governor was asked about it and really opened up some old wounds, charging partisanship.
Mm-hmm.
And he called it not one of the golden times of the council.
And Paula, before you continue, yep. Let's hear a little bit from what these folks actually had to say. You mentioned that Executive Councillor Andrew Valinsky, who's also running for governor, voted against this nomination. And here is what he said. We've got some audio provided by WMUR.
I don't hold this against Mr. Terrell, but this is an exceedingly inappropriate and demeaning appointment to a very important board.
And Governor Sununu, meanwhile, touted why Terrell would be a good nomination.
The position does not call for some expert or insider in education, all the better, frankly, that we have somebody with an outside perspective.
And despite that argument from the governor, as you said, on 3-2 on party lines, the nomination was rejected. And Ryan Terrell had something to say about that.
They're not looking at the full spectrum of who I am. They're looking at very particular sections that I'm lacking to be able to perform on the board, but they're not acknowledging the other diverse experiences of skill set and diversity of experience that I have to bring to the board.
So, as you mentioned, Paula, the Democrats went out of their way to say this is not about race, but race has come into the conversation. To what extent has this come into the conversation? What are people saying about it?
Well, note is that this is the second nomination of a Republican black man to a board that the governor has put forward and received pushback. I remember right after the governor nominated Eddie Edwards to the executive director of professional licensure.
Eddie Edwards, who was once a congressional candidate
he was a Republican congressional candidate for this position that Pappas now has.
Mm-hmm.
And he came over to the table at the executive council, and he said to me, this man does not have the experience for this job. This is a political appointment, and I am going to oppose it. And he then went on to say that he would like to have a public hearing on it. This is on March 11th. So this was just before the pandemic. And the governor pointed out yesterday during the press conference that Eddie Edwards is still waiting for a hearing. And there was, during the council meeting, Valinsky said that he was not going to address the issue of tokenism, which seemed to set the governor off a bit, and other people who say that the governor is trying to bring diversity to these boards. He's trying to bring different perspectives, and that they're looking at this in a traditional way. And it also sort of opens up the wound that the governor had over a year ago when he nominated the Attorney General, Gordon McDonald, to the Chief of the State Supreme Court. And that was a 3-2 vote, again, along partisan lines. And he said that in his 6 years being on the council, he never even knew a person's political, affiliation, and that was the wrong way to go. And he continues to have these concerns about partisanship.
Though for the Democrats at that time, as it is in this time, we're concerned about experience. Gordon McDonald's experience.
Right.
He didn't have any experience as a judge.
Right. And also with Edwards, the issue is he doesn't have experience. That position of licensure, that oversees things like tattoo parlors and hair salons and things like that. And Edwards' experience has been mostly in enforcement of laws. And the governor claims that makes him a perfect candidate for that position.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for your reporting on this, Paula. We can find more of it at indepthnh.org. I want to talk about another important news story from this week, which is that the House of Representatives met for the first time since the Civil War somewhere other than the State House in Concord. The UNH Whittemore Center, which was big enough to provide sufficient physical distance between lawmakers. Here's House Speaker Steve Shurtleff remarking on the occasion.
Up until a few months ago, I never thought I'd see the day that we members of the New Hampshire House would not be able to meet in our historic chamber.
But that day arrived. And before we talk about what did and did not get done, maybe turn to you, Gary Reno of InDepth NH. Can you tell us a little bit about how lawmakers took precautions to prevent the spread of COVID-19 among each other?
Well, when it all arrived, they were taking the temperatures were taken. They were asked a series of questions. And then they were given masks and a plastic shield. And they were supposed to wear either one or the other on the floor of the Whittemore Center. And they could take it off if they wanted to sit in the quote-unquote freedom seats, which the section reserved for those who refused to wear either one.
And those were in sort of the nosebleed seats of this section, right?
Well, they're part of the regular seating, the regular stadium seating in the arena.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another section for people who medically couldn't wear the mask. They were all separated by 6 feet. Chairs were set up that way. They were given their lunch on the floor, so it was just all set up so that everybody was supposed to be socially distanced. They're supposed to be wearing masks. And they were all checked as they came into the building to make sure that they didn't have a temperature.
I see. Okay. And Gary, this was not, to put it mildly, the House's most productive session. Why not, broadly speaking? What happened?
Well, I think, it's the first session outside of the State House since the Civil War, but the Civil War broke out down there and has been breaking out for a while.
Civil War between lawmakers on party lines, I imagine.
Party lines, yes. What happened basically was they needed to change the rules because the rules all expired while they were on suspension after the legislative session for the coronavirus. And what you needed was 2/3 vote to change the rules. And what they wanted to do was to have two more session days, one for acting on Senate bills and one to work with the Senate on bills going back and forth that had been changed. And otherwise, the deadlines are all gone. So anything that had to come before them had to have a 2/3 vote. And they were not going to get a 2/3 vote because Republicans had already caucused and said, we were not going to go along. They felt like the leadership of the House hadn't involved them in any of the decisions about this special session or any of the priorities. Steve Shurtleff, the House Speaker, basically called that a lie, and it's been degenerating from there since all this started occurring about 3 weeks ago.
And I want to turn to you, Ethan DeWitt, of the Concord Monitor. So you were reporting on this as well. What was your sense of what happened? Do you agree with Gary? Was it sort of a civil war? Ethan, are you there?
Hi, yes. Can you hear me? My connection's getting bad.
Oh, sorry about that. So what was your impression of what took place at the Whittemore Center? Not much was accomplished, kind of a partisan battle. What do you make of what went on?
Yeah, so I think it was just a lot of just, I mean, I think there was, to start, there was a lot of well-deserved congratulations around for the way the event was run. I think that it was kind of remarkable just being there, that there were just so many moving parts. But below that, and below the success of that, there was really kind of a simmering anger that had been building up for weeks between the two sides. And unfortunately, my connection cut out. I couldn't hear what Gary was saying. But I would just say it kind of came down to a communication breakdown from the Republican side. They say that they've been shut out of the process for developing the bills. Normally, you would have these committee hearings where kind of everything could be aired out, and you know, there'd be minority reports, and there would be discussions over whether something is going on the consent calendar. And they say that in this time of pandemic, the minority members of these departments, these committees who are crafting these bills, they've been largely ignored by the Democrats. Democrats reject that. They say that committees came together with priority lists. Doug Leahy.
Sorry, Ethan. It seems like we've lost the connection really briefly. Listeners, want to let you know what's coming up. We're give us a call if you have questions about the week's news. Of course, in a little bit, we're going to be talking with Brad Cook, chair of the Secretary of State's Select Committee on 2020 Election Support. We'll talk about how the state is preparing for this year's primary and general elections during the pandemic. So, what do you want to know? Want the state to do to prepare? Give us a call 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. That's coming up in about 8 to 10 minutes or so. We'll go back to you, Gary Reyno of In-Depth NH, because there's more to be done in the Senate. And this week in the Senate, you reported on the Education Omnibus Bill, which contains, among other things, changes to the way students can be disciplined. Can you talk about what this bill calls for with respect to suspensions and expulsions from school?
Well, the two key parts of it are the discipline, changing in the discipline policy. It's typically, we have local control in New Hampshire, which means that every school has their own different policy. And there's been this push for quite some time now to sort of eliminate, there's been an awful lot of, shall we say, suspensions and expulsions. And so people are kind of concerned that maybe we ought to be looking at something else in terms of disciplining students. So this basically says that expulsion or suspension has to be a last resort, that we really should be looking at what we used to call behavior modification, a system of rewards and punishments and so on, to change behavior rather than to just sort of kick kids out of school for a while to let everything settle down. They're coupling this with the thing with a program basically to provide mostly mental health, but other various support services to help these kids with their behavior. And it's a 2 to 3 tiered process, that they're working with. So they're trying to put this all together along with a whole bunch of other stuff so that we have an education omnibus bill. And they're doing this with a lot of different areas. They're doing it in transportation, they're doing it in housing, they're doing it with financial institutions, they're doing it with healthcare. So we're having probably have about a dozen or more of these bills that are just loaded up. We used to call them Christmas trees.
Right.
They have everything hung off them. And what the strategy is, because they have support in the Senate, most of these are bipartisan, largely bipartisan. There may be one or two votes against it, but they are working together to get these bills. What they're doing is they're basically taking all these other bills that are out there and putting them all in place. And that way, when they can send it, they can pass it to the Senate, send it to the House. And one of the things that the House can do without a two-thirds majority, and we saw it yesterday, is concur with changes or disagree with changes that the Senate made to its bill. Mm-hmm. So all of these Christmas trees are going to be House bills. And then when they get passed the Senate, then the House, with a majority vote, can agree to these bills and send them to the governor. What the governor does, who knows? But this way they get to salvage a good part of the session. And if they didn't do this, I mean, the House end of things would just sort of be over as of yesterday.
I see. So there's more legislative work to be done. So what will you be reporting on in the coming week, Gary?
Well, certainly we'll be looking at the Senate and see what happens on that on Tuesday. And there'll be some more work in that respect with what's going on now with these bills, trying to fine-tune what they want to put through to get to the House.
Well, Gary, thank you very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thanks also to Paula Tracy. Paula, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Paula Tracy, Gary Reno of InDepthNH.org. You can find all of their stories at InDepthNH.org. We lost the connection with Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Technology is what it is sometimes, but thanks very much to Ethan for being on the program today. Really appreciate it. You can find links to his stories at our website, NHPR.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and still to come, we'll talk with Brad Cook, chair of the Secretary of State's Select Committee on 2020 Election Support, about preparations underway for this year's elections. The coronavirus pandemic poses a challenge to those who might want to vote in person but can't because of elevated health risk. So how is the state making space for those voters? Tell us your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. This week, the Secretary of State's Select Committee on 2020 Emergency Election Support outlined recommendations for what voting should look like this year. Secretary of State Bill Gardner assembled the panel in April to advise his office on how to plan for the upcoming elections and specifically how to spend the more than $3.1 million in emergency election funding New Hampshire received as part of a federal coronavirus relief package. To talk about this now, we've got attorney Brad Cook, chair of the committee, on the line. Brad Cook, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome. It's nice to be here.
So let us know, how are voters and poll workers going to be safe when voting this year during the September 8th primary and then the November 3rd general?
As you said, the Secretary of State asked this committee of six people to make recommendations on spending the money that was received from the federal government to help with the complexities that COVID-19 is bringing to the election system. We had to look at the whole election system to figure that out. And so we had hearings about 15 days with everybody that wanted to talk, able to talk, and we've been very gratified that people appreciated the chance to talk about it. So the question is, how is it going to be safe? And the answer is, we're going to have elections both in person and by absentee. And our report says in-person elections will continue, but the safest way to keep voters and election workers safe during the fall primary and general election is for as many voters as possible to vote by absentee ballot. So that's pretty simple, but it's not a simple situation because as we operated, we kept peeling the layers back on the onion and finding more things that also could be implicated, like changing party affiliation, which had to be done by June 2nd, like filing for office, which has to be done by today, like sending in applications, like the forms that we presently have, which could be misleading to people who see that it says disabled as a reason for absentee. Now, the Attorney General and Secretary of State have said that fear of the coronavirus is a disabling condition. It's not a disability, but it's the equivalent, and it will allow absentee voting.
So people who know all this stuff. So I'm sorry. So people who normally wouldn't think of themselves as having a disability, they now can say, if I am afraid of COVID-19 for whatever reason, I can say, yes, I have a disability and therefore be eligible to vote by absentee ballot.
Well, the definition of disability has been changed for this election cycle to include that, because we certainly wouldn't equate people with disabilities who are, you know, a legitimate category of people with you and me who might be afraid of getting the virus and therefore say we have a disability. But it allows it to be used. And, you know, we went over all kinds of things. Obviously, the spending of the money is going to have to cover PPE, personal protective equipment, for polling workers and for voters who do go to the polls. The cost of increased number of absentee ballots, the processing of increased numbers of absentee ballots, publicizing this whole thing. One of our recommendations was an all household mailing by the Secretary of State to tell people how they can avail themselves of this. And we asked for prepaid postage for the return of absentee ballots because some people might not be able to afford the cost of sending them back.
So it sounds like the efforts are geared towards reducing any and all barriers for those who want to vote, whether it be financial or concerns about health.
That's correct.
So how will the average voter learn about the option to use absentee ballots? You mentioned a mailing, but is that approved? Is everybody in the state with a mailing address going to get some kind of notification about this?
We made recommendations to the Secretary of State. He has to decide within the boundaries of our recommendations what priorities to use, because I think if all of our recommendations were fully funded, it'd be a lot more than $3.2 million. So
I see.
But that was our recommendation. It is cheaper to send an all-household mailing, we found out. We learned all kinds of stuff about postage and the kinds of postage and rates and stuff, but that the all-household mailing has the advantage that if people have moved, it still goes to the house. And if instead of all voters, 10% of the voters change between every four-year election, we learned. So there'd be a huge amount of misplaced or misdirected mail. So I hope he's going to do that. But the answer to your question is, you're going to do it. The union leader is going to do it.
Right.
Commercial radio is going to do it. I'm going to do it. I sent an email out today with the links to the Secretary of State's website that have downloadable forms to ask for absentee ballots. Colleges are going to do it for students. Businesses are going to do it for their employees. One of our recommendations was free publicity, which means as many people should tell others about how this is going to happen as possible. And if you listen to the news, and I listen to the news every day on NPR, but if you listen to the news, you heard what happened in the last 2 weeks in southern and larger states that just had primaries, not a general election, just primaries, and the increased number of absentee ballots and the lines created a terrible situation. So this is real, and I think people are getting aware of it.
Well, there is still the option for those who want to vote in person. So if they want to show up either in the primary or the general later this year, is there going to be, you know, personal protective equipment on hand, hand sanitizer, that kind of stuff?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There'll be some available. Obviously, the poll workers, it's going to be like going to the grocery store when you sign in. There's going to be a plastic sheet, I assume, between, or a plastic plexiglass thing between you and the poll worker. There are going to have to be separation of polling booths. There has to be separation of people in line. The real question that grabs you, if you were just talking about the freedom section of the legislature yesterday, where the people who didn't want to wear masks could sit, and I've got an idea where they ought to sit, but that's a different issue. What if a voter shows up and says, I'm not wearing a mask? You can't give me a mask because I won't wear a mask. I think this is all hokum. You know, as we've said before, if you go to Hannaford's and won't wear a mask, they have a right to ask you to leave, but you've got a constitutional right to vote.
So if someone shows up without a mask, they can still vote, is what you're saying.
Well, how are you going to deal with the person who refuses to take the mask that you're offering him mm-hmm. or her because they just have some kind of disbelief that this is real? You know, and we have recommendations in there on various options for that.
But the option is not to say, sorry, you can't vote. You can't say that.
I'm not the Attorney General of New Hampshire, but my suspicion is people have a right to vote.
Okay. So I don't know how far into the future this committee is looking, but let's say we get past September and past November, and the recommendations you've put in place are taken. Absentee voting goes really well. Turnout is good. People seem happy with it. If this makes it easier to vote, why not continue it?
Our charge and our report dealt with 2020. I think of the six people, you would probably get probably four different opinions on that question. And we stuck to our knitting because our knitting was tough enough. So I'm not a big fan of mail, voting by mail in normal times, because I think our system creates the largest turnout and safest voting. So, you know, I'm not a big proponent of it, but that's a conversation for another day. And this may be a laboratory to test it.
Well, Brad Cook, chair of the Secretary of State's Select Committee on 2020 Election Support, thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
And listeners, you can find NHPR's Casey McDermott's reporting on this issue at nhpr.org. That's it for today, but I want to thank all our guests for being on the program today. Your insights are very, very valuable. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Jane Vaughn is a production fellow for The Exchange, and our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.